In the case of free fall, Galileo's genius was to design the rolling ball experiment with two criteria in mind. First, he had to slow things down enough so that he could measure them. Equally important, he sought to minimize the effects of air resistance and friction. Although friction and air resistance are part of our everyday experience, he felt that they obscure the simplicity of the fundamental laws that govern nature. Rocks might fall faster than feathers in the real world, but the underlying laws, Galileo suspected, dictated that in a vacuum, they would fall at the same rate. "We must cut loose from these difficulties," he wrote, and having discovered and demonstrated the theorems in the case of no resistance, use them and apply them to the real world with such limitations as experience will teach. For small tilts, the balls in Galileo's experiment rolled rather slowly, and the data was relatively easy to measure. He noted that with these small angles, the distance covered by the ball was always proportional to the square of the time interval. One can show mathematically that this means the ball had gained speed at a constant rate. That is, the ball was undergoing constant acceleration. Moreover, Galileo noted that the ball's rate of fall did not depend on how heavy it was. What was striking was that this remained true even as the plane was tilted at ever steeper angles. No matter what angle the tilt, the distance the ball covered was independent of the ball's weight and proportional to the square of the time it took to roll. But if that is true for a tilt of 40, 50, 60, even 70 or 80 degrees, why not 90? And so now comes Galileo's very modern-sounding reasoning. He said that his observations of the ball rolling down the plane must also hold true for free fall, which one can consider as equivalent to the limiting case in which the plane is tilted at 90 degrees. In other words, he hypothesized that if he tilted the plane all the way so that it was vertical and the ball was actually falling rather than rolling, it would still gain speed at a constant rate, which would mean that the law he observed for inclined planes also holds for free fall. In this way, Galileo replaced Aristotle's law of free fall with his own. Aristotle had said things fall at a speed that is proportional to their weight, but Galileo, postulating an idealized world in which the fundamental laws reveal themselves, came to a different conclusion. In the absence of the resistance provided by a medium such as air, all objects fall with the same constant acceleration. If Galileo had a taste for mathematics, he also had a penchant for abstraction. It was so well developed that he sometimes liked to watch scenes play out entirely in his imagination. Non-scientists call these fantasies. Scientists call them thought experiments, at least when they pertain to physics. The good thing about imagining experiments conducted purely in your mind is that you avoid the pesky issue of setting up apparatus that actually works, but are nevertheless able to examine the logical consequences of certain ideas. And so, in addition to sinking Aristotle's theory about free fall through his practical experiments with inclined planes, Galileo also employed thought experiments to join the debate regarding one of the other central criticisms of Aristotle's physics, the criticism that concerned the motion of projectiles. What is it that, after the initial force applied when a projectile is fired, continues to propel it forward? Aristotle had guessed it might be particles of air that rush in behind the projectile and continually push it. But even he was skeptical of that explanation, as we've heard. Galileo attacked the issue by imagining a ship at sea, with men playing catch in a cabin, butterflies fluttering about, fish swimming in a bowl at rest upon a table, and water dripping from a bottle. He noted that these all proceed in exactly the same manner when the ship is in steady motion as when the ship is at rest. He concluded that because everything on a ship moves along with the ship's motion must be impressed upon the objects, so that once the ship is moving, its motion becomes a sort of baseline for everything on it. Couldn't, in the same way, the motion of a projectile be impressed upon the projectile? Could that be what keeps the cannonball going? Galileo's ruminations led him to his most profound conclusion, another radical break with Aristotle's physics. Denying Aristotle's assertion that projectiles require a reason for their motion, a force, Galileo proclaimed that all objects that are in uniform motion tend to maintain that motion, just as objects at rest tend to stay at rest. By uniform motion, Galileo meant motion in a straight line and at a constant speed. The state of rest, then, is simply an example of uniform motion in which the velocity happens to be zero. Galileo's observation came to be called the law of inertia. Newton later adapted it to become his first law of motion. A few pages after stating the law, Newton adds that it was Galileo who discovered it, a rare instance of Newton giving credit to someone else. The law of inertia explains the problem of the projectile that had plagued the Aristotelians. According to Galileo, once fired, a projectile will remain in motion unless some force acts to stop it. Like Galileo's law of free fall, this law is a profound break from Aristotle. Galileo was asserting that a projectile does not require the continual application of force to keep it in motion. In Aristotle's physics, continued motion in the absence of a force or cause was inconceivable. On the basis of what I had told him about Galileo, my father, who liked to compare any important person you were talking about to some figure from Jewish history, called Galileo the Moses of science. He said it because Galileo led science out of the Aristotelian desert and toward a promised land. That comparison is especially apt because, like Moses, Galileo did not make it to the promised land himself. He never went so far as to identify gravity as a force, or to decipher its mathematical form. That would have to wait for Newton. And he still clung to some of Aristotle's beliefs. For example, Galileo believed in a kind of natural motion that isn't uniform and yet needn't be caused by a force. Motion in circles around the center of the Earth. Galileo apparently believed that it is that type of natural motion that allows objects to keep up with the Earth as it rotates. These last vestiges of Aristotle's system would have to be abandoned before a true science of motion could arise. For reasons such as this, one historian described Galileo's concept of nature as an impossible amalgam of incompatible elements born of the mutually contradictory worldviews between which he was poised. Galileo's contributions to physics were truly revolutionary. What he is most famous for today, however, is his conflict with the Catholic Church, based on the assertion that, contrary to the view of Aristotle and Ptolemy, the Earth is not the center of the universe, but just an ordinary planet, which, like the others, orbits the sun. The idea of a heliocentric universe had existed as far back as Aristarchus in the 3rd century BC, but the modern version can be credited to Copernicus. Copernicus was an ambivalent revolutionary whose goal was not to challenge the metaphysics of his day, but simply to fix ancient Greek astronomy. What bothered him was that in order to make the Earth-centered model work, one had to introduce a great many complicated, ad hoc geometric constructions. His model, on the other hand, was much more refined and simpler, even artful. In the spirit of the Renaissance, he appreciated not just its scientific relevance, but its aesthetic form. "I think it is easier to believe this," he wrote, "than to confuse the issue by assuming a vast number of spheres, which those who keep Earth at the center must do." Copernicus first wrote about his model privately in 1514, and then spent decades making astronomical observations that supported it. But like Darwin, centuries later, he circulated his ideas discreetly, only among his most trusted friends, for fear of being scorned by the populace and the church. And yet, if Copernicus felt the danger, he also knew that with proper politicking, the church's reaction could be tempered. And when Copernicus finally did publish, he dedicated the book to the Pope with a long explanation of why his ideas were not heresy. In the end, the point was a moot one, for Copernicus didn't publish his book until 1543, and by then he lay stricken on his deathbed. Some say he didn't even see a final printed version of his book until the very day he died. Ironically, even after his book was published, it had little immediate impact until later scientists like Galileo adopted it and began to spread the word. Though Galileo didn't invent the idea that the Earth is not the center of the universe, he contributed something just as important. He used a telescope, which he improvised based on a much more rudimentary version that had been invented not long before, to find startling and convincing evidence for that view. It all started by accident. In 1597, Galileo was writing and lecturing in Padua about the Ptolemaic system, giving little indication that he had any doubts about its validity. Meanwhile, at around the same time, an incident occurred in Holland that reminds us of the importance in science of being in the right place, in this case Europe, at the right time, in this case just decades after Copernicus. The incident, which would eventually cause Galileo to change his thinking, took place when two children who were playing in the shop of an obscure spectacle maker named Hans Lippershey put two lenses together and looked through them at a distant weather vane atop the town's church. It was magnified. According to what Galileo later wrote about this event, Lippershey looked through the lenses, one convex and the other concave, and noted the unexpected result, and thus invented the instrument. He had created a spyglass. We tend to think of the development of science as a series of discoveries, each leading to the next through the efforts of some solitary intellectual giant with a clear and extraordinary vision. But the vision of the great discoverers of intellectual history is more often muddled than clear, and their accomplishments more indebted to their friends and colleagues, and luck, than the legends show and than the discoverers themselves often wish to admit. In this instance, Lippershey's spyglass had a magnifying power of only 2 or 3, and when Galileo first heard about it some years later, in 1609, he was unimpressed. He became interested only because his friend Paolo Sarpi, described by historian J. L. Heilbronn as a redoubtable anti-Jesuit polymathic monk, saw potential in the device. He thought that if the invention could be improved, it could have important military applications for Venice, an unwalled city dependent for its survival on early detection of any impending enemy attack. Sarpi turned for help to Galileo, who, among his many and various ventures to supplement his income, had a sideline making scientific instruments. Neither Sarpi nor Galileo had any expertise in the theory of optics, but through trial and error, in a few months Galileo developed a 9-power instrument. He gifted it to an awestruck Venetian Senate in exchange for a lifetime extension of his appointment and a doubling of his then salary to 1,000 scudi. Galileo would eventually improve his telescope to a magnifying power of 30, the practical limit for a telescope of that design, a plano-concave eyepiece and a plano-convex objective. Around December 1609, by which time Galileo had already developed a telescope with a magnifying power of 20, he turned it skyward and aimed it at the largest body in the night sky, the moon. That observation, and others he would make, provided the best evidence to date that Copernicus was correct about the Earth's place in the cosmos. Aristotle had claimed that the heavens form a separate realm, made of a different substance and following different laws, which cause all heavenly bodies to move in circles around the Earth. What Galileo saw, though, was a moon that was uneven, rough, and full of cavities and prominences, being not unlike the face of the Earth, relieved by chains of mountains and deep valleys. The moon, in other words, did not seem to be of a different realm. Galileo saw, too, that Jupiter had its own moons. The fact that these moons orbited Jupiter and not the Earth violated Aristotle's cosmology while supporting the idea that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but merely one planet among many. I should note here that when I say Galileo saw something, I don't mean that he simply put the scope to his eyes, pointed it somewhere, and feasted on a revolutionary new set of images as if he were watching a show at the planetarium. Quite the contrary. His observations required long periods of difficult and tedious effort, for he had to squint for hours through his imperfect, poorly mounted glass and struggle to make sense of what he saw. When he gazed at the moon, for example, he could see mountains only by painstakingly noting and interpreting the movement over a period of weeks of the shadows they cast. What's more, he could see only 1/100th of the surface at a time, so to create a composite map of the whole, he had to make numerous scrupulously coordinated observations. Such difficulties illustrate that, with regard to the telescope, Galileo's genius lay not so much in perfecting the instrument as in the way he applied it. For example, when he perceived what seemed to be, say, a lunar mountain, he wouldn't simply trust appearances. He would study the light and shadows and apply the Pythagorean theorem to estimate the mountain's height. When he observed Jupiter's moons, he at first thought they were stars. Only after multiple careful and meticulous observations and a calculation involving the known motion of the planet did he realize that the positions of the stars, relative to Jupiter, were changing in a manner that suggested they were circling. Having made these discoveries, Galileo, though reluctant to enter the theological arena, became eager to be recognized for them. And so he began to devote much energy to publicizing his observations and crusading to replace the accepted cosmology of Aristotle with the sun-centered system of Copernicus. Toward that end, in March 1610, he published The Starry Messenger, a pamphlet describing the wonders he had seen. The book was an instant bestseller, and though it was, in modern format, only about 60 pages long, it astounded the world of scholars, for it described marvelous, never-seen-before details of the moon and planets. Soon Galileo's fame spread throughout Europe, and everyone wanted to peer through a telescope. That September, Galileo moved to Florence to take the prestigious position of chief mathematician of the University of Pisa and philosopher of the Grand Duke. He retained his prior salary, but had no obligation to teach or even reside in the city of Pisa. The Grand Duke in question was the Grand Duke Cosimo II de' Medici of Tuscany, and Galileo's appointment was as much the result of a campaign to curry favor with the Medicis as it was due to his grand accomplishments. He had even named the newly discovered moons of Jupiter the Medician planets. Soon after the appointment, Galileo fell terribly ill and remained bedridden for months. Ironically, he probably had the French disease, syphilis, a product of his attraction to Venetian prostitutes. But even while ill, Galileo continued striving to persuade influential thinkers of the validity of his findings. And by the following year, when he had regained his health, his star had risen so high that he was invited to Rome, where he gave lectures about his work. In Rome, Galileo met Cardinal Maffeo Barberini and was granted an audience at the Vatican with Pope Paul V. It was a triumphant trip in every way, and Galileo seems somehow to have finessed his differences with official church doctrine so as to cause no offense, perhaps because most of his lectures focused on the observations he had made with his telescope without much discussion of their implications. It was inevitable, though, that in his subsequent politicking, Galileo would eventually come into conflict with the Vatican, for the Church had endorsed a version of Aristotelianism created by St. Thomas Aquinas that was incompatible with Galileo's observations and explanations. In addition, unlike his politic predecessor Copernicus, Galileo could be insufferably arrogant, even when consulting theologians regarding church doctrine. And so, in 1616, Galileo was summoned to Rome to defend himself before various high-ranking officials of the church. The visit seemed to end in a draw. Galileo was not condemned, nor were his books banned, and he even had another audience with Pope Paul. But the authorities forbade him to teach that the sun, not the earth, is the center of the universe, and that the Earth moves around it rather than vice versa. In the end, the episode would prove to have caused him a huge problem, for much of the evidence used against Galileo in his Inquisition trial 17 years later would be drawn from the meetings during which the church officials had explicitly forbidden him to teach Copernicanism. For a while, however, the tensions eased, especially after Galileo's friend Cardinal Barberini became Pope Urban VIII in 1623. For unlike Pope Paul, Urban held a generally positive view of science, and in the early years of his reign, he welcomed audiences with Galileo. Encouraged by the friendlier atmosphere, with Urban's rise, Galileo began work on a new book, which he finished when he was 68 in 1632. The fruit of that labor was entitled Dialogo sopra i due massimi sistemi del mondo. In English, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, Ptolemaic and Copernican. But the dialogue was extremely one-sided, and the church reacted, with good reason, as if the book's title were Why Church Doctrine is Wrong and Pope Urban is a Moron. Galileo's dialogue took the form of a conversation between friends, Simplicio, a dedicated follower of Aristotle, Sagredo, an intelligent neutral party, and Salviati, who made persuasive arguments for the Copernican view. Galileo had felt comfortable writing the book because he had told Urban about it, and Urban had seemed to approve. But Galileo had assured the Pope that his purpose in writing it was to defend the church and Italian science from the charge that the Vatican had banned heliocentrism out of ignorance. And Urban's approval was based on the proviso that Galileo would present the intellectual arguments on both sides without judgment. If Galileo had indeed striven for that, he failed miserably. In the words of his biographer J. L. Heilbrunn, Galileo's dialogue dismissed the fixed earth philosophers as less than human, ridiculous, small-minded, half-witted, idiotic, and praised Copernicans as superior intellects. There was another insult. Urban had wanted Galileo to include in the book a disclaimer, a passage affirming the validity of church doctrine. But instead of stating the disclaimer in his own voice, as Urban had asked, Galileo had the affirmation of religion voiced by his character Simplicio, described by Heilbrunn as a nincompoop. Pope Urban, being no nincompoop himself, was deeply offended. When the stardust had settled, Galileo was convicted of violating the Church's 1616 edict against teaching Copernicanism and forced to renounce his beliefs. His offense was as much about power and the control or ownership of truth as it was about the specifics of his worldview. The truth is, most of those who formed the intellectual elite of the Church recognized that the Copernican view was probably correct. What they objected to was a renegade who would spread that word and challenge the doctrine of the Church. On June 22, 1633, dressed in the white shirt of penitence, Galileo knelt before the tribunal that had tried him and bowed to the demand that he affirm the authority of the Scriptures, declaring, I, Galileo, son of the late Vincenzo Galilei, Florentine, aged 70 years, swear that I have always believed, do believe, and by God's help will in the future believe, all that is held, preached, and taught by the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Roman Church. Despite proclaiming that he had always accepted church doctrine, however, Galileo went on to confess that he had advocated the condemned Copernican theory, even after an injunction had been judicially intimated to him by the Church, to the effect that he must, in the Church's words, abandon the false opinion that the sun is the center of the world and immovable, and that the earth is not the center of the world and moves. What's really interesting is the wording of Galileo's confession. I wrote and printed a book, he said, in which I discuss this new doctrine already condemned, and adduce arguments of great cogency in its favor. So even while pledging allegiance to the Church's version of the truth, he still defends the content of his book. In the end, Galileo capitulates by saying that, desiring to remove from the minds of your eminences and all faithful Christians this strong suspicion justly conceived against me, with sincere heart and unfeigned faith, I abjure curse, and detest the aforesaid errors and heresies, and I swear that in the future I will never again say or assert, verbally or in writing, anything that might furnish occasion for a similar suspicion regarding me. Galileo would not receive as harsh a punishment as the Inquisition had leveled on Giordano Bruno, who had also declared that the earth revolved around the sun, and for his heresy was burned at the stake in Rome in 1600. But the trial made the position of the church quite clear. 2 days later, Galileo was released to the custody of the Florentine ambassador. He spent his last years under a kind of house arrest in his villa at Arcetri, near Florence. While living in Padua, Galileo had fathered 3 children out of wedlock. Of them, the daughter to whom he had been extremely close had died of the plague in Germany, and his other daughter was estranged from him. But his son, Vincenzo, lived nearby and took loving care of him. And although he was a prisoner, Galileo was allowed visitors, even heretics, provided they were not mathematicians. One of them was the young English poet John Milton, who would later refer to Galileo and his telescope in Paradise Lost. Ironically, it was during his time at Arcetri that Galileo recorded his most fully worked out ideas on the physics of motion, in the book he considered to be his greatest work, Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations Relating to 2 New Sciences. The book could not be published in Italy due to the Pope's ban on his writings, so it was smuggled to Leiden and published in 1638. By then, Galileo's health was failing. He had become blind in 1637, and the next year he began to experience debilitating digestive problems. "I find everything disgusting," he wrote. "Wine absolutely bad for my head and eyes, water for the pain in my side. My appetite is gone. Nothing appeals to me, and if anything should appeal, the doctors will prohibit it." Still, his mind remained active, and a visitor who saw him shortly before his death commented that, despite the prohibition on visitors of that profession, he had recently enjoyed listening to 2 mathematicians argue. He died at age 77 in 1642, the year Newton was born, in the presence of his son Vincenzo and, yes, a few mathematicians. Galileo had wanted to be buried next to his father in the main basilica of Santa Croce in Florence. Grand Duke Cosimo's successor, Ferdinando, had even planned to build a grand tomb for him there, across from that of Michelangelo. Pope Urban let it be known, however, that it is not good to build mausoleums to such men, because the good people might be scandalized and prejudiced with regard to holy authority. And so, Galileo's relatives deposited his remains instead in a closet-sized chamber under the church's bell tower and held a small funeral attended by only a few friends, relatives, and followers. Still, many, even within the church, felt the loss. Galileo's death, the librarian at the court of Cardinal Barberini in Rome courageously wrote, touches not just Florence, but the whole world, and our whole century that from this divine man has received more splendor than from almost all the other ordinary philosophers. Chapter 7. The Mechanical Universe. When Galileo published his Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations Relating to 2 New Sciences, he had brought human culture only to the brink of a new world. Isaac Newton took the last giant steps and in the process completed the blueprint for an entirely new way of thinking. After Newton, science abandoned the Aristotelian view of nature driven by purpose and embraced instead a Pythagorean universe driven by numbers. After Newton, the Ionian assertion that the world could be understood through observation and reason was transformed into a grand metaphor. The world is like a clock, its mechanisms governed by numerical laws that make every aspect of nature precisely predictable, including, many believed, human interactions. In faraway America, the founding fathers embraced Newtonian thinking in addition to theology to assert in the Declaration of Independence that the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle people to political self-determination. In France, after the Revolution and its antagonism toward science, Pierre Simon de Laplace, took Newtonian physics to a new level of mathematical sophistication, and then proclaimed that, employing Newtonian theory, a superior intellect could embrace, in the same formula, the motions of the greatest bodies in the universe and those of the slightest atoms. Nothing would be uncertain for it, and the future, like the past, would be present to its eyes. Today we all reason like Newtonians. We speak of the force of a person's character and the acceleration of the spread of a disease. We talk of physical and even mental inertia and the momentum of a sports team. To think in such terms would have been unheard of before Newton. Not to think in such terms is unheard of today. Even those who know nothing of Newton's laws have had their psyches steeped in his ideas. And so to study the work of Newton is to study our own roots. Because Newton's vision of the world is now second nature to us, it takes effort to appreciate the astonishing brilliance of his creation. In fact, in high school, when I was first introduced to Newton's laws, they appeared so simple that I wondered what all the fuss was about. I found it odd that it had taken one of the smartest people in the history of science many years to create what I, a boy of 15, could learn in just a few lectures. How could concepts so easily accessible to me have been so difficult to grasp a few hundred years ago? My father seemed to understand. While I tell my kids stories of inventions like post-it notes, my father usually turned to tales of the old country. When people looked at the world hundreds of years ago, he told me, they saw a reality very different from what we perceive today. He told me of a time when, as a teenager in Poland, he and some friends had put sheets over a goat, which then raced through the family's home. The elders all thought they had seen a ghost. Okay, it was the night of the Jewish holiday Purim, and the elders were all rather drunk, but my father didn't use their inebriation to explain away their reaction. He said they were merely interpreting what they saw in terms of the context of their beliefs. And the ghost concept was one they were used to and comfortable with. I might consider that ignorant, he said, but what Newton would tell the world about the mathematical laws of the universe probably seemed just as strange to people of that day as his elders' ghosts do to me. It's true. Today, even if you've never taken a course in physics, a bit of Isaac Newton's spirit resides within you. But had we not been raised in a Newtonian culture, those laws that are now so self-evident to all of us would have been, for most of us, incomprehensible. Describing his life shortly before his death, Newton put his contributions this way. I don't know what I may seem to the world, but as to myself, I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore, and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble, or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered before me. Each of Newton's pebbles could have constituted a monumental career for scholars less brilliant and productive than him. In addition to his work on gravity and motion, he devoted many years to uncovering the secrets of optics and light, and he invented physics as we know it today, as well as calculus. When I told this to my father, who hadn't heard of Newton until I began studying his work, he frowned and said, "Don't be like him, stick to one field." At first I reacted to that with the kind of condescension teenagers specialize in. But actually, my father might have had a good point. Newton did come perilously close to being a genius who started much and finished nothing. Luckily, as we'll see, fate intervened, and today Newton is credited with ushering in an entire revolution of thought. One thing Newton never did do, actually, was play at the seashore. In fact, though he profited greatly from occasional interaction with scientists elsewhere in Britain and on the continent, often by mail, he never left the vicinity of the small triangle connecting his birthplace, Woolsthorpe, his university, Cambridge, and his capital city, London. Nor did he seem to play, in any sense of the word that most of us mean by it. Newton's life did not include many friends or family he felt close to, or even a single lover, for, at least until his later years, getting Newton to socialize was something like convincing cats to gather for a game of Scrabble. Perhaps most telling was a remark by a distant relative, Humphrey Newton, who served as his assistant for 5 years and said that he saw Newton laugh only once, when someone asked him why anyone would want to study Euclid. Newton had a purely disinterested passion for understanding the world, not a drive to improve it for the benefit of humankind. He achieved much fame in his lifetime, but had no one to share it with. He achieved intellectual triumph, but never love. He received the highest of accolades and honors, but spent much of his time in intellectual quarrel. It would be nice to say that this giant of intellect was an empathetic, agreeable man, but if he had any such tendencies, he did a good job suppressing them and coming off as an arrogant misanthrope. He was the kind of man who, if you said it was a gray day, would say, "No, actually, the sky is blue." Even more annoying, he was the kind who could prove it. Physicist Richard Feynman voiced the feelings of many a self-absorbed scientist when he wrote a book titled, "What Do You Care What Other People Think?" Newton never wrote a memoir, but if he had, he probably would have called it, "I Hope I Really Pissed You Off," or maybe, "Don't Bother Me, You Ass." Stephen Hawking once told me that there was a sense in which he was glad to be paralyzed, because it allowed him to focus much more intensely on his work. I suppose that Newton could have said, for the same reason, that there were marvelous advantages to living entirely in his own world, rather than wasting time by sharing it with anyone else. In fact, a recent study reports that students who are brilliant in math have a significantly greater tendency to go into a scientific career if they don't have great verbal skills. I have long suspected that having poor social skills is also correlated to success in science. I have certainly known quite a few successful scientists who'd have been considered too odd to employ anywhere except at a major research university. One fellow graduate student wore the same pants and white t-shirt every day, though it was rumored he actually had two sets of them, so his clothes did occasionally get washed. Another fellow, a famous professor, was so shy that when he spoke to him, he'd generally avert his eyes, speak very softly, and step back if he noticed that you were standing closer than 4 feet away. The latter two behaviors caused issues during post-seminar chit-chat because they made him difficult to hear. At our first encounter during my graduate school days, I made the mistake of approaching too closely and then naively following him as he backtracked, with the result that he almost fell over a chair. Science is a subject of magnificent beauty, but although progress in science requires the cross-fertilization of ideas that can result only from interaction with other creative minds, it also demands long hours of isolation, which may confer a distinct advantage on those who would rather not socialize or even prefer to live apart. As Albert Einstein wrote, "One of the strongest motives that leads men to art and science is escape from everyday life with its painful crudity and hopeless dreariness." Each makes this cosmos and its construction the pivot of his emotional life in order to find in this way the peace and security which he cannot find in the narrow whirlpool of personal experience. Newton's disdain for the everyday pursuits of the world allowed him to pursue his interests with few distractions, but it also led him to withhold much of his scientific work, choosing not to publish the vast bulk of his writings. Fortunately, he didn't throw them out either. He was a pack rat worthy of his own reality show. Only, instead of hoarding pet carcasses, old magazines, and shoes he'd outgrown at age 7, Newton's stuff consisted of scribblings on everything from mathematics, physics, alchemy, religion, and philosophy, to accounts of every penny he ever spent, and descriptions of his feelings about his parents. Newton saved virtually everything he wrote, even sheets of throwaway calculations and old school notebooks, making it possible for those who wished to dig to understand to an unprecedented degree the evolution of Newton's scientific ideas. Most of his scientific papers were eventually donated to the library at Cambridge, his intellectual home, but other papers, totaling millions of words, were eventually sold at Sotheby's, where economist John Maynard Keynes was one of the bidders, buying most of Newton's writings on alchemy. Newton's biographer, Richard Westfall, spent 20 years studying his life, concluding in the end that Newton was not finally reducible to the criteria by which we comprehend our fellow human beings. But if Newton was an alien, at least he was an alien who left behind diaries. Newton's struggle to understand the world stemmed from an extraordinary curiosity, an intense drive toward discovery that seemed to come completely from within, like the impulse that drove my father to trade his piece of bread for the solution to that math puzzle. But in Newton's case, there was something else that fueled that drive. Though he is revered as a model of scientific rationality, his inquiries into the nature of the universe were, like those of others going all the way back to Göbekli Tepe, intricately tied to his spirituality and religion. For Newton believed that God is revealed to us through both his word and his works, so that to study the laws of the universe is to study God, and the zeal for science just a form of religious zeal. Newton's penchant for solitude and his long hours of work were, at least from the point of view of his intellectual achievements, great strengths. If his retreat into the realm of the mind was a boon for science, however, it came at a great cost to the man and seems to have been connected to the loneliness and pain of his childhood. When I was in school, I felt bad for the kids who weren't popular, especially since I was one of them. Newton, though, had it worse. He was unpopular with his own mother. He had come into the world on December 25th, 1642, like one of those Christmas gifts you hadn't put on your list. His father had died a few months earlier, and his mother, Hannah, must have thought that Isaac's existence would prove a short-lived inconvenience, for he was apparently premature and not expected to survive. More than 80 years later, Newton told his niece's husband that he was so tiny at birth that he could have fit into a quart pot, and so weak he had to have a bolster around his neck to keep it on his shoulders. So dire was the little bobblehead situation that two women who were sent for supplies a couple of miles away dawdled, certain that the child would be dead before they returned. But they were wrong. The neck bolster was all the technology needed to keep the infant alive. If Newton never saw the use of having people in his life, perhaps that was because his mother never seemed to have much use for him. When he was 3, she married a wealthy rector, the Reverend Barnabas Smith. More than twice Hannah's age, Smith wanted a young wife, but not a young stepson. One can't be sure what kind of family atmosphere this led to, but it's probably safe to assume there were some tensions, since, years later, in notes he wrote about his childhood, Isaac recalled threatening my father and mother Smith to burn them and the house over them. Isaac did not say how his parents had reacted to his threat, but the record shows that he was soon banished to the care of his grandmother. Isaac and she got along better, but the bar had been set pretty low. They certainly weren't close. In all the writings and scribbles Isaac left behind, there was not a single affectionate recollection of her. On the bright side, there are also no recollections of his wanting to set her on fire and burn the house down. When Isaac was 10, the Reverend Smith died, and he returned home briefly, joining a household that now included the 3 young children from his mother's second marriage. A couple of years after Smith's death, Hannah shipped him off to a Puritan school in Grantham, 8 miles from Woolsthorpe. While studying there, he boarded in the home of an apothecary and chemist named William Clark, who admired and encouraged Newton's inventiveness and curiosity. Young Isaac learned to grind chemicals with a mortar and pestle. He measured the strength of storms by jumping into and against the wind and comparing the distance of his leaps. He built a small windmill adapted to be powered by a mouse running on a treadmill, and a 4-wheeled cart he would sit in and power by turning a crank. He also created a kite that carried a lit lantern on its tail and flew it at night, frightening the neighbors. Though he got along well with Clark, his classmates were a different story. At school, being different and clearly intellectually superior brought Newton the same reaction as it would today. The other kids hated him. The lonely but intensely creative life he led as a boy was preparation for the creative but tortured and isolated life he would lead for most, though happily not all, of his adult life. As Newton approached the age of 17, his mother pulled him out of school, determined that he should return home to manage the family estate. But Newton did not do well as a farmer. Proving you can be a genius at calculating the orbits of the planets and a total klutz when it comes to growing alfalfa. What's more, he didn't care. As his fences fell into disrepair and his swine trespassed in cornfields, Newton built water wheels in a brook, or just read. As Westfall writes, he rebelled against a life spent herding sheep and shoveling dung. Most physicists I know would. Fortunately, Newton's uncle and his old schoolmaster from Grantham intervened. Recognizing Isaac's genius, they had him sent off to Trinity College, Cambridge, in June 1661. There he would be exposed to the scientific thinking of his time, only to one day rebel and overturn it. The servants celebrated his parting, not because they were happy for him, but because he had always treated them harshly. Cambridge would remain Newton's home for more than 3.5 decades, ground zero for the revolution in thought that he launched during that time. Though that revolution is often portrayed as consisting of a series of epiphanies, his struggle to master the secrets of the universe was really more like trench warfare, one grueling intellectual battle after another, in which ground was won gradually and at great cost in energy and time. No one of lesser genius or less fanatical dedication could possibly have prevailed in that struggle. At first, even Newton's living conditions were a source of struggle. When Isaac went off to Cambridge, his mother granted him a stipend of just £10, though she herself had a comfortable yearly income of more than £700. The stipend landed him at the very bottom of the Cambridge University social structure. A sizar in the rigid Cambridge hierarchy was a poor student who received free food and tuition and earned a small amount of money by attending to wealthier students, dressing their hair, cleaning their boots, bringing them bread and beer, and emptying their chamber pots. To be a sizar would have been a promotion for Newton. He was what was called a sub-sizar, someone who had the same menial duties as a sizar, but had to pay for his own food, as well as for the lectures he attended. It must have been hard for Newton to swallow, becoming the servant of the same breed of boys who'd always tormented him at the Grantham School. And so at Cambridge, he got a taste of what life was like downstairs. In 1661, Galileo's Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations relating to two new sciences was just over 2 decades old, and like his other works, it hadn't yet had much effect on the Cambridge curriculum, which meant that in exchange for his service and his fees, Newton was treated to lessons that covered everything scholars knew about the world, as long as those scholars were Aristotle. Aristotelian cosmology, Aristotelian ethics, Aristotelian logic, Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian physics, Aristotelian rhetoric. He read Aristotle in the original, he read textbooks in Aristotle, he read all the books in the established curriculum. He finished none of them, for like Galileo, he did not find Aristotle's arguments convincing. Still, Aristotle's writings constituted the first sophisticated approach to knowledge that Newton was exposed to, and even as he refuted them, he learned from the exercise how to approach the diverse issues of nature and to think about them in an organized and coherent manner, and with astounding dedication. In fact, Newton, who was celibate and rarely engaged in recreational activities, worked harder than anyone I have ever heard of, 18 hours per day, 7 days a week. It was a habit he would adhere to for many decades. Dismissive of all the Aristotle studies that made up the Cambridge curriculum, Newton began his long journey toward a new way of thinking in 1664, when his notes indicate that he had initiated his own program of study, reading and assimilating the works of the great modern European thinkers, among them Kepler, Galileo, and Descartes. Not a terribly distinguished student, Newton nonetheless managed to graduate in 1665 and to be awarded the title of scholar, along with 4 years of financial support for additional studies. Then, in the summer of 1665, a terrible outbreak of plague afflicted Cambridge, and the school closed down, not to reopen again until spring 1667. While the school was closed, Newton returned to his mother's home in Woolsthorpe and continued his work in solitude. In some histories, the year 1666 is called Newton's Annus Mirabilis. According to that lore, Newton sat at the family farm, invented calculus, figured out the laws of motion, and, after seeing a falling apple, discovered his universal law of gravitation. True, that wouldn't have been a bad year, but it didn't happen that way. The theory of universal gravitation wasn't as simple as a single bright idea that could be had through an epiphany. It was an entire body of work that formed the basis of a whole new scientific tradition. What's more, that storybook image of Newton and the apple is destructive because it makes it seem as if physicists make progress through huge and sudden insights, like someone who's been hit on the head and can now predict the weather. In reality, even for Newton, progress required many hits on the head and many years in which to process his ideas and come to a true understanding of their potential. We scientists endure the headaches from those hits because, like football players, we love our sport more than we hate the pain. One reason most historians doubt the story of the miraculous epiphanies is that Newton's insights into physics during the plague period came not all at once, but over a period of 3 years, 1664 to 1666. Moreover, there was no Newtonian revolution at the end of that period. In 1666, even Newton was not yet a Newtonian. He still thought of uniform motion as arising from something internal to the moving body, and by the term gravity, he meant some inherent property arising from the material an object is made of, rather than an external force exerted by the earth. The ideas he developed then were only a beginning that left him baffled and floundering about many things, including force, gravity, and motion, all the basics that would eventually constitute the subject of his great work, Principia Mathematica. We have a pretty good idea what Newton was thinking on the farm in Woolsthorpe because, as was his habit, he wrote it all down in a huge, mostly blank notebook he had inherited from Reverend Smith. Newton was lucky to have that notebook and, in his later years, to have sufficient paper for the millions of words and mathematical notations in which he recorded his work. I've mentioned innovations such as the university and the use of mathematical equations, but there are other unsung enablers of the scientific revolution that we take for granted. Prominent among them, the growing availability of paper. Fortunately for Newton, the first commercially successful paper mill in England had been established in 1588. Just as important, the Royal Mail Service was opened to the public in 1635, making it possible for the antisocial Newton to correspond on paper with other scientists, even those in far-flung places. But paper was still dear in Newton's day, and he treasured the notebook, which he called the Waste Book. In it, we find the details of Newton's approach to the physics of motion, a rare glimpse into the still-developing ideas of a brilliant mind. We know, for example, that on January 20, 1665, Newton began entering into his Waste Book an extensive mathematical, rather than philosophical, investigation of motion. Crucial to the analysis was his development of calculus, a new kind of mathematics designed for the analysis of change. In the tradition of Orem, Newton conceived of change as the slope of a curve. For example, if you graph the distance an object has traveled on the vertical axis against time on the horizontal axis, then the slope of the graph represents its speed. A flat line thus represents an unchanging position, while a steep line or curve indicates that the object's position is changing drastically, that it is moving at a high speed. But Orem and others interpreted graphs in a more qualitative manner than we do today. A graph of distance versus time, for example, was not understood to represent at each point the distance traveled at the time indicated by the coordinate on the horizontal axis. Nor was the slope of the graph understood to represent the object's speed at each moment. Instead, speed to physicists before Newton meant average speed, the total distance traveled divided by the length of time the journey took. Those were pretty crude calculations because the times they considered in those calculations were typically hours, days, or even weeks. In fact, it wasn't possible to measure short times with any precision until 1670, when English clockmaker William Clement invented the pendulum-based grandfather's clock, which finally made it possible to measure time to the nearest second. To move beyond averages, to the values of graphs and their slopes at each individual point was the revelation in Newton's analysis. He addressed an issue no one had ever addressed before. How do you define the instantaneous speed of an object, its speed at each instant? How do you divide the distance traveled by the time it took when the time interval involved is actually a single point? Does this even make sense? In his waste book, Newton attacked this problem. If Galileo liked to envision limiting cases, such as a plane that is tilted more and more until it approaches vertical, Newton took the idea to a whole new extreme. To define the instantaneous speed at a given point in time, he imagined first calculating the average speed in the traditional way over some interval of time that included the point in question. Then he imagined something new and abstract, shrinking that interval more and more until, in the limiting case, its size approaches zero. In other words, Newton imagined that you can make a time interval so small that it would be tinier than any finite number, and yet greater than zero. Today we call the length of such an interval infinitesimal. If you calculate the average speed over a time interval and shrink that interval down to the infinitesimal, you get the speed of the object at an instant, its instantaneous speed. The mathematical rules for finding the instantaneous speed at a given time, or more generally, the slope of a curve at a given point, form the basis of calculus. If atoms are the indivisibles from which chemical compounds are made, infinitesimals are like indivisibles that build space and time. With his calculus, Newton had invented the mathematics of change. With regard to motion in particular, he introduced a sophisticated understanding of instantaneous velocity to a culture that had only recently created its first ever way of measuring speed. By tossing a knotted rope anchored by a log off the stern of a ship and counting the number of knots that go past in a given time. Now, for the first time, it made sense to speak of an object's speed, or the change of anything, at a particular moment. Today, calculus is used to describe changes of all sorts. The way air flows over airplane wings, the way populations grow and weather systems evolve, the ups and downs of the stock market, the evolution of chemical reactions. In any enterprise in which you might graph a quantity, in all areas of modern science, calculus is a key tool. Technically, population growth and stock market prices, being discrete and not continuous quantities, are not governed by calculus, but these systems are often approximated as continuous. Calculus would eventually allow Newton to relate the amount of force applied to an object at any given time to its change in velocity at that moment. Moreover, it would show how one could add up all those infinitesimal changes in velocity to derive an object's path as a function of time. But those laws and methods would not come for decades. In physics, as in mathematics, Newton's waste book went far beyond anything yet envisioned. Prior to Newton, for example, the collision of two objects was looked at as a kind of contest between the internal constitutions of the two, like two muscular gladiators vying to toss each other out of the arena. In Newton's way of thinking, though, each body is analyzed only in terms of the external cause applied to it, that is, force. Despite that advance in thinking, in the more than 100 axioms of his waste book related to this problem, Newton provides only a flawed and convoluted picture of what he meant by force. In particular, he gives no clue as to how to quantify force, such as that exercised by the pull of the earth, or that causing the change of motion of an object. The picture Newton began to paint during the years at Woolsthorpe is a picture he wouldn't perfect for almost 20 years, and a far cry from the spark needed for the Newtonian Revolution. Physicist Jeremy Bernstein tells a story about a visit to the United States in 1958 by Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli. Pauli presented a theory to an audience at Columbia University that included Niels Bohr, who seemed skeptical. Pauli conceded that at first sight his theory might look somewhat crazy, But Bohr replied that no, the problem was that the theory was not crazy enough. At that, Pauli turned to the audience and argued, "Yes, my theory is crazy enough." Then Bohr insisted, "No, your theory is not crazy enough." Soon the two physicists were both stalking around the front of the room, yelling and sounding like fifth graders. I bring this up to make the point that all physicists and all innovators have more wrong ideas than right ones, and if they are very good at what they do, they also have crazy ideas, which are the best kind, though only if they are right, of course. Sorting out the right from the wrong is not an easy process. It can take a lot of time and effort. We should therefore have some sympathy for people with outlandish ideas. In fact, Newton was one of them. After having made such an auspicious start during the plague, he spent much of the next phase of his life pursuing wrong ideas that many scholars who studied his work have thought of as crazy. It all started off well enough. In spring 1667, shortly after Cambridge reopened, Newton returned to Trinity College. That fall, Trinity held an election. We all at times face discrete situations that will have an outsized effect on our future. Personal challenges, job interviews that can change our lives, college or professional school entrance exams that may have a great influence on our later opportunities. The Trinity College election was, for Newton, all this rolled into one. Its results would determine whether the 24-year-old would be able to remain at the university in a higher position called fellow, or have to return to a life of herding sheep and shoveling dung. His prospects didn't look good, for there hadn't been elections at Trinity College in 3 years, and there were only 9 openings, but far more candidates, many of whom had political connections. Some even had letters signed by the king commanding their election. But Newton did get elected. With his farming career now behind him for good, one might think that Newton would have buckled down and proceeded with the business of turning his wastebook thoughts on calculus and motion into Newton's laws. But he didn't. Instead, over the next few years, Newton did notable work in 2 very different fields, optics and mathematics, in particular algebra. The latter paid off handsomely in that he was soon looked upon as a